Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This year marks the 60th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board of Education. On May 17, 1946, the court unanimously struck down separate but equal segregation in public schools and ruled that the racial segregation of children violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Public school desegregation has been celebrated as an historic accomplishment, but what has Brown v. Board of Education really achieved over the past 60 years, and where are we today? In a year-long investigation, ProPublica reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones looks at the history of public school desegregation by focusing on three generations of the same family in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. She writes, quote, "In Tuscaloosa today, nearly one in three black students attends a school that looks as if Brown v. Board of Education never happened. Tuscaloosa schools today are not as starkly segregated as they were in 1954, the year the Supreme Court declared an end to separate and unequal education in America. No all-white schools exist anymore. The city's white students generally attend schools with significant numbers of black students. But while segregation as it is practiced today may be different than it was 60 years ago, it is no less pernicious in Tuscaloosa and elsewhere," end quote. Nicole Hannah-Jones is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. She covers civil rights with a focus on segregation and discrimination in housing and schools, and you can find her most recent report at yourcallradio.org. Tuscaloosa, Alabama is one of the most rapidly resegregating districts in the country, and Nicole joins us from New York. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Gary Orfield, a professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at UCLA. Gary also co-directs the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, and he's co-author of Educational Delusions, Why Choice Can Deepen Inequality, and How to Make Schools Fair, The Resegregation of Suburban Schools, A Hidden Crisis in American Education, and Higher Education and the Color Line. And Gary joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. So, Nicole, you spent an entire year focusing on this lengthy package of investigative pieces. And based on your findings, as we are marking the 60th anniversary of this landmark decision, you believe that people, for the most part, are pretty much in denial about where we are today.
I do. I think that there's a great deal of denial about two things. I think there's a denial about kind of the breadth of segregated schools, that this is not just a Southern issue, that it's a national issue. And I also think that there's a great deal of denial about the harm that that still causes. You still hear really from the presidential level on down to just a parent in a local school district the idea that separate can be made equal.
Mm. And Gary, you've been following this, you've been writing about this issue for a long time now, and how are you feeling as we're marking the 60th anniversary?
Well, it's very sad because there's going to be a lot of celebrations and self-congratulation, and nobody's going, who is in a position of power, is going to really acknowledge that we've been going backwards for at least a quarter century for black students, and really for much longer than that for Latinos who weren't very segregated at the time of Brown in some parts of the country, like California, but now are extremely segregated.
How would you describe what we are facing right now to people who might really not know what's really happening on the ground?
Well, we're facing a different society than existed at the time of Brown, when over 80% of the students in the country were white and African Americans were the dominant minority group, and we were basically focusing on the intense segregation in the 17 states that had mandatory segregation under their state constitutions. Now we have a much more multiracial country where about half of the students are non-white, and where we also have a very high level of poverty among young people. And we have these vast patterns of segregation emerging that aren't just affecting African Americans, but are even more intensely affecting Latinos, who are by far our largest minority group now.
And Nicole, you focus specifically on Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which is one of the most rapidly resegregating districts in the country. Why did you decide to focus on that city? How did you learn about what's happening there?
So I early on in my research, I came across a report by Sean Reardon and his some other professors at Stanford University that was looking at resegregation in districts once they had been released from federal court orders. So I asked Professor Reardon to send me a list of the districts that were resegregating most rapidly, and Tuscaloosa was in the top, one of the top 10 districts. So doing a little bit more reporting, I became really interested in Tuscaloosa because it had actually managed to create a perfectly integrated system for 6th through 12th graders, and by perfect I mean not without its flaws, but that every student in the city went to the same middle school and the same high school. And then after being released from court order, within months, the district chose to undo that and create an all-black feeder system of schools. And I was very curious why a school system would make that decision.
So why did they?
They made it for a lot of reasons, and all of these issues are very complex, but there was a lot of fear about white flight, which is a very common phenomenon, and there was a belief that the court order was leading to white flight and that there needed to be, in a district that had turned 75% black, there needed to be a cluster of schools where white students would be in the majority or close to the majority in order to keep white parents in the district.
And we'll talk about specifically what you found in Tuscaloosa, but as you said, this is not just a Southern issue, and I would bet that a lot of people assume that this is just happening in the South, but you've said that based on your reporting, this is actually a nationwide issue. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely, and Professor Orfield's work definitely makes this very clear. He just released his Civil Rights Project at UCLA, just released a report showing that where I live, actually New York City, has the most segregated schools in the country. And so the reason that I focused on the South was the South had actually made the most progress, and it had really and has been the most integrated region of the country for decades. And it also educates the most black children of any of the regions in the country. But the reaction has often been, I can't believe how backwards they are down South. Mm-hmm. I can't believe they're still doing that. And my response to that is, actually, the fight in the South is to try to keep it from looking like the Northeast and the Midwest, where schools are much more segregated.
And so we're going to talk also about grassroots efforts to end racial disparities. But what really stood out for you in the South that's actually working?
Well, I think there are, you know, where there is a community will and where a community truly values integration, you do see that it works. And two great examples of that are Louisville, Kentucky, and Wake County in North Carolina, where they've had extensive busing for years because the community has valued it, and they remain highly integrated school districts, urban school districts, but also districts that have managed to hold on to their white populations and provide a quality education. But those instances where you have that kind of really, where it really is a community value, seem to be kind of few and far between.
And Professor Orfield, why don't you tell us a little bit about this notion? I mean, elaborate on that a bit, that a lot of people believe that this is still happening in the South, but based on your research, New York is one of the most segregated areas in the country.
People have, you know, back in the 1960s, it was the Chicago's and the New York's and the Los Angeles that sent freedom riders and civil rights workers into the South and really helped create a social revolution. But by 1970, the South, thanks to the Civil Rights Act and the courts actually enforcing desegregation, was the most integrated part of the country for public schools. And there's been a kind of persistent denial in the West and the North ever since. They tend to think of this as a Southern problem and don't notice what's going on in their own metropolitan areas. Though almost any place in the country where you actually drive across a metropolitan area and visit schools as you go across it, you find different worlds. People are just in denial of that, and there really has been no leadership from most public officials or educational leaders for a long time about this issue. And the Supreme Court has been pushing us backwards now ever since the early 1990s. people don't recognize that either, but it's made a huge difference.
And I know that there are so many complexities to this, but how do you explain how New York became the most segregated part of the country?
Well, New York, Michigan, and Illinois have been leading the parade on segregation for a long time, and California is catching up on some dimensions. The reason why those places are so segregated is that they have very segregated housing markets and very fragmented metropolitan areas and really no integration policies. You add the, and they're also now putting in large numbers of even more segregated charter schools. So you add those things together and you get a very high level of segregation. Basically, underneath the school problem, we have a problem of residential segregation that's very serious and that just hasn't been addressed well. It's improving mildly for African Americans, except in some of the biggest metros, but it's getting somewhat worse for Latinos.
In the case of New York, I mean, we're seeing this in California also, major income disparities,
yes,
especially among, you know, people of color. How, when you look at how to address this at, in a place like New York or California, what do you think, how do you think politicians should step up to the plate? And we'll obviously first talk about it, but what policy changes would you like to see?
Well, there's a lot of things that could be done. One of the things that about the United States is a very mobile country. The average person moves every 6 years or so. So if we were to create different flows into neighborhoods and schools, we'd make a huge difference. What we really have is some frontiers where we could make a difference pretty fast. Many suburbs, hundreds of suburbs around the country are going through racial change, and there really isn't any policy to help them stabilize. We need to address those issues, or else we're going to have more neighborhoods like we have in central cities. On the other hand, we have lots of young, highly educated people of all races moving into some of our functional central cities and gentrifying neighborhoods, but they're not creating integrated schools, in part because the school districts aren't doing anything to attract and incorporate them into those schools where they could add a lot. So if we just started thinking about those issues, we could begin to make an effect quickly. We have had a huge expansion of choice programs in the country, really fostered very actively by the Clinton and Bush and Obama administrations. But those choice programs, with charter schools particularly, have not incorporated the lessons of good magnet schools about how to create diversity and help stabilize communities. They're very segregated, and really many of them have no really good civil rights policies. They could contribute positively. They're actually making the situation worse in most of our communities.
That is Gary Orfield, professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at UCLA. He also directs the Civil Rights Project there. And they're out with a new report that found New York City has some of the most segregated schools in the country, with California not too far behind. He's the co-author of several books, including Educational Delusions, Why Choice Can Deepen Inequality, and How to Make Schools Fair. We're also joined by Nicole Hannah-Jones, an investigative reporter with ProPublica. Her most recent investigation, it's a year-long investigation, documents the resegregation of Southern schools through an intensive look at Tuscaloosa, Alabama, one of the most rapidly resegregated districts in the country. And we'd love to hear from you. If you work in education or if you have kids in school, what really strikes you about what you see in California or if you live in a different part of the country? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And both of our guests say that as we're marking the 60th anniversary, so many people are really in denial about what we're currently facing. And part of the reason is because politicians are not really talking about the realities that we're facing in schools. So if you're also part of a group or if you know of efforts to end racial disparities, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think actually works? What really needs to change? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And then we're also going to talk about the harm that this causes on the ground. How does this really affect students and their ability to really thrive in education? And Nicole, same question to you, just based on the reporting you've done over the past year, talking with educators and advocates on the ground, what changes would they like to see to really tackle this issue?
Well, I think a lot of this stems from the fact that these kids are not only being separated by race, but they're also being separated by income, and that more middle-class Black and Latino students are the ones who are more likely to attend integrated schools, and what's kind of left behind are the very poorest Black and Latino students. And so there are a couple things, of course, resources, and by resources I don't necessarily mean financial, but in terms of, are these kids getting the same curriculum? Often they're not. They're often not given the same opportunity to take college-level classes. They are often, the longer time that these kids spend in segregated schools, the larger the achievement gap grows. So instead of closing the achievement gap, these schools actually exacerbate it. I think also just the separation itself, which we often kind of lose that when we talk about Brown, that that ruling was not on resources, but that in a country with a history of racial caste, that very separation is damaging. And I think the Supreme Court said, you know, it's so damaging that it may never be undone. And talking with student after student in the segregated high school in Tuscaloosa, they definitely feel that there's a stigma attached to them, that people don't want to learn around them, that they're not necessarily wanted in the community, that people assume that their school is bad and dangerous, so that they are dumb because they attend the school, and that stigma is very real for them.
Mm. Well, we have a number of callers on the line. Let's hear from Sydney in San Francisco. Hi, Sydney. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's an important show. I'm afraid I want to muddy the waters by bringing up other topics which seem to me to impinge on this one. The whole question of respect for children needs to be looked at. The children are, by the way, I'm a civil rights veteran. I was in the South during the civil rights movement and had the pleasure of celebrating 50 years at a party quite recently. And I worked in the Bayview as well as in Harlem with successful results. So I'm concerned because the question isn't just what is the color of the children in your class or in your school, but rather what is the quality of the program and is it respectful of you? And with the current emphasis on testing, which limits teaching, and the current kind of teacher preparation which most institutions have, and with young teachers who leave after the first year because they had no idea how difficult it would be with the adults, let alone with the children, we have a morass, and I think until the society begins to treat our children with the respect that it has, say, for our automobiles and our highways, and supplying the money necessary to get the best people and cutting bureaucracy down to the nub and valuing the most important resource we have, which is our children, not for later, but for now as well. I think we're in deep water.
Well, thank you for calling, Sydney. Professor Orfield, what are your thoughts on the focus on testing, and how does that affect this issue?
There's an important link here, because basically in the Reagan era, there was a radical shift in federal education policy and state educational policy away from the emphasis on poverty and race that came out of the Great Society and the Civil Rights era to an emphasis on creating equality through standards, assessment, and sanctions, and through creating semi-private schools, charter schools. The basic idea here was that if we raise the standards enough and we punish the schools enough, that they would produce equal outcomes, and that we could just basically ignore the dual segregation by race and poverty that we have across the country. But the result of it, with No Child Left Behind, which was the extreme form of this, was that we punished and sanctioned the schools and the teachers who were serving the most segregated kids. And we ignored the inequalities that those kids brought to school that the society wasn't addressing, and we ignored the effect of segregation. So we ended up creating working conditions and educational conditions in these deeply segregated schools that made things worse, that made educational leaders and teachers want to get away from those schools into more privileged schools. So we've got a situation where we have a policy that blames the teachers and the schools, that doesn't give them the assistance they need, that ignores the underlying causes of lots of the inequality, and that drives them to leave those schools even more rapidly. And this is extremely destructive, and it's part of the consequence of simply ignoring the racial and poverty inequality in the society and what it means for schooling.
Mm. And Nicole, what did you hear from teachers and parents during your investigative work about testing, the focus on testing?
Well, I think everyone kind of understands that focus ends up punishing schools for the populations that they serve and also stigmatizing students. One of the things I heard over and over from students is we work as hard as we can, and then the standardized test results come out and everyone calls our school a failing school. And that has a very detrimental effect on the psyche of students, to be constantly told that they are at a failing school, and of course that means that it's their fault, they're not smart enough to pass the test.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think that we have really come to view the benefits of integration in a very kind of small, unnatural way, which is how well can someone perform on a standardized test, when really when you look at what the Supreme Court was trying to do in Brown, was understanding that integrating schools was going to be the building block for racial equality in every other aspect of life. And if you look at studies that look at how does a desegregated education impact kind of long-term results, it has huge impacts on everything from poverty, likelihood to go to jail, mm-hmm. likelihood to live an integrated life, to work in an integrated job, to send your kids to integrated schools. So those focusing so narrowly on test scores, I think, gives us an easy alternative to actually doing the real work.
And I wonder, when you're talking to young kids, I mean, how do they see all of this? Racial segregation, testing, schools that are clearly not equal to other schools, when you look at things as simple as, you know, the basketball hoop or whatever. I mean, schools are clearly so, they look so different depending on where the kids come from. I mean, in California right now, unfortunately, we have to rely on PTA money to buy school supplies and teachers mm-hmm. and things like that. So I wonder how kids, specifically poor kids of color, see these issues.
I mean, they see it as them not being valued,
mm-hmm.
that people, I mean, in Tuscaloosa, I showed very clearly that the all-black high school was created through gerrymandering, and that means that the kids who live, the school is actually located in an integrated, heavily white, actually, neighborhood, and those kids who live right next to the school are districted to go to a school that's 3 to 4 miles away. And so you have the black students at this high school are saying, how come these kids who live right across the street from our school don't attend our school? And they understand implicitly why that is. They say it's because we're a black school mm-hmm. and people don't want to send their kids to a black school. And so I think it's extremely damaging to these kids. And then to learn on top of that they're not getting the same classes as the integrated schools are. For years, Central High School in Tuscaloosa, those kids couldn't even get the same advanced diplomas as other high schools in the city could get. And so to pretend that somehow we have made the separation equal, those kids know that that is not true.
Today we are talking about the 60th anniversary of a landmark Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board of Education. The court unanimously struck down separate but equal segregation in public schools. But today's guests say we are mostly in denial about what we are currently facing, and we'll continue this conversation after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that has not yet been heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. You can also send your comments or questions via email if you like. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes, the BBC's World Have Your Say. Today they're asking whether the Nigerian government is at the heart of the country's problems. And that's World Have Your Say, coming up in 30 minutes at 11 from the BBC here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with the nation's political sports writer Dave Zirin about his new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. We will talk about massive protests in Brazil over its decision to host the World Cup. And then we'll also talk about the socioeconomic effects on mega sports events, especially on poor communities. That's tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, Ralph Nader will be joining us. He's out with a new book called Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And on Thursday, Bruce Laurie is out with a book called Talks In, Talks Out, How to Get Harmful Chemicals Out of Our Bodies and Our World. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are marking the 60th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board of Education. On May 17, 1946, the court unanimously struck down separate but equal segregation in public schools and ruled that the racial segregation of kids violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Today's guests and so many people who follow this say that most of the country is in denial about what's really happening, and most people believe that the South is the most segregated part of the country for public schools. But today's guest, Gary Orfield, co-director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, is out with a new report that says New York is actually more segregated, with California not far behind. Gary Orfield is professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at UCLA, co-author of many books, including The Resegregation of Suburban Schools, A Hidden Crisis in American Education. We are also joined by Nicole Hannah-Jones, an investigative reporter with ProPublica. She spent a year investigating the resegregation of Southern schools through an intensive look at Tuscaloosa, Alabama, one of the most rapidly resegregating districts in the country. And you can find her package of reports at yourcallradio.org. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What do you see in your area where your child goes to school? Did you decide to send your child to a different school because of these issues? If you work in education, what are your thoughts on public segregation 60 years after Brown v. Board? And then what are the best solutions to make sure that we can end racial disparities in public school? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I wanted to ask you, Professor Orfield, before we get back to calls, when we talk about these issues, we tend to look at it from a fairly academic perspective, which I think is really, really important. But also, I think it's so important to talk about the effect this does have on the children. And Nicole just talked to us about, you know, the conversation she had with these students, basically saying that they're not worth what the students in the next neighborhood are worth. Can you also talk about that?
Yeah, one of the perspectives that I have on this comes from teaching students who come from very different kinds of high schools into college. I taught an undergraduate class a number of years at UCLA, where we get wonderful students, but a number of our students are from high schools from totally different worlds. Some of them are from high schools that prepare you to go any place in the world, that give you state-of-the-art preparation, that you're ready for a very competitive college. And other kids come into my office in tears, basically, because when they came to UCLA, they got in because they were very smart and they worked very hard in their high school and so forth. But they weren't prepared. They didn't have the essentials. They'd never written a research paper. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what the other kids were talking about. And they thought that in the world where they were growing up, they were doing absolutely everything that was asked of them. They were the best that they could be. But they weren't given what all the other kids got basically as a matter of right because of where they lived and went to school. It is so deep and the worlds are so separate that only when you get into a place where you are with people who have had very different kinds of preparation do you realize how profoundly unequal your opportunities have been.
Hmm. How do you deal with that in the classroom when you have these students from such different backgrounds? I'm sure it's probably amazing to watch them learn from each other.
It is. It's very important because a lot of the kids from really privileged backgrounds in California have no notion at all. I mean, they just think that it's all a merit, that they're there because of their own personal merit and so forth. and a lot of kids from very disadvantaged backgrounds, and we have lots of schools that are almost totally segregated by both race and class, they don't realize what the other kids are getting until they meet them and see how unequal it's all been. So if you're teaching in a situation like that, you have to be prepared to give some extra help to kids who haven't gotten what they're supposed to get in high school. It's part of the debate about affirmative action. Do we have a level playing field? In California right now, if you look at the top 10th of our high schools, almost half of Asian kids in the state are in those top 10th. About a quarter of whites, 4% of blacks, 3% of Latinos. The playing field isn't equal. It's really, really deeply unequal. And the worlds are so separate that neither the privileged kids nor the kids that are really deeply disadvantaged understand that until they get in the setting where they meet each other. And I don't think the public in the state understands it at all. And they just think that everybody has a reasonable chance to get prepared and the most meritorious succeed. There's tremendous differences in opportunity systems.
Well, we have a number of callers on the line, so let's go next to Lena in San Francisco. Hi, Lena. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Hello. Okay, so I'm going to probably bring up something a little bit more controversial. And I'll preface it by saying my child, 6 years old, goes to a private school. Within a year of going to that school, he came home four times and said he wanted to be white. And the primary reason is he's the only black child in this class with all white teachers and all white students. And he already has noticed that he's being treated significantly different, mostly by being blamed for a variety of things that children do. He's always the bad one because he's the black child, because he's the black boy. So the controversy I'm having internally is I'm struggling with the whole construction of segregated schools. I think it's a very complex issue. I don't think segregated schools are necessarily bad if the resources were equal. And so I'm wondering, what if the resources were equal? How did students perform back in the day when they were in segregated schools, for example, black children? How was their self-esteem different? Were they going to college at higher rates than they do now, for example? I understand the whole concept of unequal education, a lack of resources, but then when you put your child in, say, private or, better schools, for quote unquote, for better, lack of a word. What about the psychological aspect? So I think the deeper question is, are we training enough teachers of color to be in these school situations? So I'm going to take my answer off the air. I know it's a little complicated, but hopefully you'll know where I'm coming from.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much, Lena, for sharing your story. Nicole, you looked at these issues in your investigations in Tuscaloosa. How would you address Lena?
Well, I think that she's right. It is very complicated. And unfortunately, when you have a country with our racial history, the answers are not going to be easy or painless. And certainly, desegregation and integration wasn't a magic pill that cured everything. It's very hard to kind of compare college attendance rates and all of those things from 1954 because there's just not really any national data or a lot of times even local data to do that. What I can say is it's obvious that those schools were not equal then. I think there was more of a community pride in schools. I think that even at Central High School, the all-black high school now, those kids, some of them feel more at home at a school that is more reflective of their culture, but they also are being robbed of an equal education. And it's almost hard to say what if these schools received equal resources, because never in the history of our country has that been the case. And so there's no model to look at to show where these schools have been, where segregated black schools have been treated the same. They haven't. And really that's what integration does. It's not about kids magically learning because they're sitting next to white children, but that often resources do follow white children in this country, and in order to get access to the same resources, then kids have to be in the same schools together. And that's certainly what happened in Tuscaloosa. Once a third of the black kids were separated out of integrated schools, they were written off. They got the worst teachers, they got the worst of everything. And I think school officials and business leaders were fine with that because they said these kids' parents didn't care about school anyway. And so often we end up stigmatizing the kids in those schools. But I think, you know, most black people, surveys show, don't want their kid to be the only one. Mm-hmm. They want to go to a truly integrated school, not a school that has token integration, but where there's enough black kids, where the kid isn't alone, but also where they know their kid will be getting access to the best resources a community has, and that's almost always in white schools or in integrated schools.
Professor Orfield, how would you address Lena's comments and the personal experiences she's having with her son?
You have wonderful listeners. They give questions that would require a whole semester to answer.
We do.
Let me just address a couple elements of it. One is resources, and it's interesting because people think of resources and they think of money and books and so forth, but the most important resources that a school has are the kids who go there, their level of preparation, their families, and the teachers who are there, their level of training and their experience, and the curriculum. And all of those things are different in schools that are segregated by race and poverty, because good teachers with experience leave those schools. As soon as they get enough seniority to transfer, they get another job offer because it's hard work and they're blamed for everything in the current assessment system. The kids themselves learn from each other. We've known for 50 years that if you're in a school with better prepared classmates, you're going to learn a little more. And that's especially true for poor kids who come to school far behind. Think about the resources as being the kids, the parents, and the teachers, and the courses that the teachers are able to mount and that the students are ready to take. That's what makes a school powerful. And those things are very hard to equalize. They certainly can't be equalized just by transferring money. Now, the teachers and the way they treat kids and so forth is in part because we don't put emphasis now on training teachers to deal with diversity, and we haven't done nearly enough to get our teaching faculties diverse. We've still got a society where almost 4 in 5 teachers are white, and many from the suburbs. They don't automatically understand how to deal with kids and how to respect their culture. They need training and support to do that, and it needs to be a priority in the schools.
We have a related email from Philippe who says, I want to suggest that it would be far more productive to use whatever political capital can be mustered to change the funding of schools from a local property tax base to a statewide equality of per-student spending. The Texas Supreme Court held that the local funding model violated equal protection some years ago, but I haven't heard any details since of its implementation. He goes on to say, when the government is seen as racially favoring disadvantaged minorities, the majority population seems to turn against all social welfare efforts, for example, the Reagan Democrats. By using race-neutral efforts that have race-beneficial results, such as statewide funding of schools or economics-based affirmative action, this can be avoided. Professor Orfield, what do you think about that?
Well, most of our states have actually had school finance lawsuits. Texas is one of them. California, of course, had the first big one in the Serrano case back around 1970. We have redistributed money massively, and of course we're redistributing more here in California with the local control funding formula that Governor Brown just got elected. The problem is money does not produce equality because of these things that we talked about before. Money is necessary, but it's not sufficient. We need the money to fund the schools, but we need the teachers who are prepared to use it, and we need the other students there who are prepared and ready to learn and competitive. So, yes, money equalization or more than equalization, additional money for schools that have kids who start far behind, that's a good idea. But it doesn't make segregated schools equal. It's part of the answer, but we have to address the racial and class isolation issues as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, part of it is, yes, that can get at some of the disparities between districts, but that kind of equalization of funding at the state level doesn't get to the disparity within districts. And most of these high poverty schools actually get more money. They get Title I funding from the federal government, which only goes to high poverty schools. So, for instance, in Tuscaloosa, the high poverty black schools, they all receive more funding than the other schools. They have a smaller student-to-teacher ratio, but that's not enough to deal with the concentrated poverty within schools. And what we do know, they might be getting more money, but they're not getting the best teachers. Hmm. They're not getting the things that they really need to succeed. And I think we're looking for this post-racial answer to a problem that is still very racialized, and we have yet to find it.
And that is Nicole Hannah-Jones, an investigative reporter with ProPublica. She spent a year looking at the resegregation of Southern schools through an intensive look at Tuscaloosa, Alabama, one of the most rapidly resegregating districts in the country. And you can find her package of reports at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Gary Orfield, professor of education, law, and political science at UCLA. He directs the school's Civil Rights Project. They recently found that New York is one of the most segregated areas in the country. California is not far behind. He's the co-author of several books, including The Resegregation of Suburban Schools. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. How do you reflect back on 60 years of, it's been 60 years since the landmark Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board of Education. What are your thoughts about what was really accomplished and then where we are today? How did we get here? And what will it take to end racial disparities in public schools? If you have a personal story you'd like to share, or if you work in education, or if you remember anything about being a student and what really struck out for you about these issues, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thank you again for sharing your story, Lena. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Good morning. I wanted to be a little bit off the beaten path the way Sydney mentioned and Lena did. But before I went a little bit off the beaten path, I wanted to commend, I think it was Gary who mentioned the lack of diversity in the teaching, and that was terrific. And I wanted to also speak from my own personal experience growing up in Boston during the height of all the racial tension. Boston schools were incredibly segregated. I remember where I went to school that we had kids bussed in from Roxbury and all of that, so that basically the mantra that you all are stating about how deeply segregated cities in the North are, I had personal experience, was very correct, having grown up in Boston. My off-the-topic question, and I don't know if either of the guests know, that based on the desegregation of schools, like in Brown versus Board of Education, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act was passed that promoted the integration of kids with disabilities into mainstream education. And I was wondering if either of them knew anything about how this was panning out in schools that are implementing it so that disabled kids are integrated into the mainstream classroom.
Professor Orfield, have you looked at this?
Yes. One of the things that people don't realize is that there was a chain of events that really made schools more equal in many dimensions in the United States. Following Brown, of course, we had the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which really gave the teeth to Brown and really began to change the South. On the model of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, we had Title IX that opened the schools much more fairly to women. And then we had the education of all children that came out of litigation started in Pennsylvania. And on the model of the federal government's intervention with the Civil Rights Act, we intervene on behalf of handicapped kids. And I think it's really one of the glories of American education that we've massively committed to the education of handicapped kids. And it has been a really deep and rich investment in American education. Now, it hasn't been done perfectly, and we did a book about racial discrimination in part of special education. But by and large, I think, especially for the physically handicapped children, it has been a godsend, and it's one of the aspects of American education that really did come out of the equality impulse of the civil rights movement that we often don't connect with it. But they're all part of a policy that, and a part of a movement that whose basic goal was to open up equal opportunity for everybody.
Hmm. Is this something you looked at, Nicole?
No, I haven't. It's not in my area of expertise.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruthann. Gary, again, as we are going to be getting a lot of news articles, politicians, as you said, will be celebrating Brown v. Board. Again, can you give us some more tangible solutions to this issue? I mean, as someone who's studied this for a long time, where would you start to end racial disparities?
Well, I mean, we have a really deeply embedded set of issues, and we've never had equal employment opportunities. We've never had equal college. All of our basic institutions need to be addressed, and we need to be thinking about it on many dimensions. We really, you know, we basically shifted government's resources to the elderly away from children, and that's meant shifting really from an increasingly diverse and predominantly minority young population in many parts of the country to an elderly, predominantly white population. It's really unhealthy for our country that we're doing this, and we need to think about how to shift resources back to the young and to create a vision about raising our young together. In California, only a little more than a quarter of the students are white. About one-seventh are Asian. Everybody's going to need to be able to operate across racial and ethnic lines if our institutions are going to function. And we're going to have to develop the talent of the kids we actually have rather than the kids that these institutions were originally designed for. We have really some deep thinking to do, and we need another social movement on the scale of the one that followed Brown in the 1960s for us to begin to reconceptualize these things. Obviously, we want to have better preschool so the kids don't come to school so unequally prepared. We want to do what we can through choice systems and through other methods to bring kids together. We want to help stabilize and integrate our neighborhoods through much better fair housing enforcement and for different uses of housing subsidy resources and other things. What we really need is a central vision that we want to have an integrated and fair society where everybody's prepared to live and work together, and then to start putting all those pieces in place. And, you know, it's not on the agenda now. We have one party that's been playing on racial fears and one that has been kind of tiptoeing around the issue without discussing it openly. Mm. It can't be solved without acknowledging it, without affirming a goal and beginning to put those pieces in place. Now, we do have lots of experience in this country that we didn't have before the Civil Rights Revolution about situations in which integration has actually worked. And we need to look at those and make them models for the rest of the country.
And Nicole, what are parents and people who care about these issues doing in their communities to deal with or end, really, racial disparities? What's really working on the ground?
Well, I think it really has to be about valuing all children, and I think we tend to really care about the school that our kids are in or the neighborhoods that we live in and don't really see this as an entire community. I think there's a lot of othering of kids who are black and brown and live in poor communities. One thing I've heard over and over is it's not the schools, it's the parents, and that these kids don't care, these kids don't want an education. And I think until we really start to value all children as our children, then we're not going to see a lot of change. But what you do have, and this has actually happened in Tuscaloosa after 2007, when the school district passed another rezoning plan that further segregated the schools, there was really a biracial coalition of parents who said that this was not acceptable, and they began trying to organize. They voted in new school board members who were more equity-minded. So I think that communities have to really see this as a value, to not be in denial, to realize that these are everyone's kids, and to really value integration as something that a community that wants to be just is interested in.
Well, we have time for one last quick caller. Let's hear from Dee in Oakland. Hi, Dee.
Oh, hi, thank you. And thank you, guests, for the pipe dreams. But there is a history of African-American private schools that send 95% of the kids to college. So And there is a history of that. So what we need is to look at what those schools are. There are private schools. Nobody, I mean, I could care less about going to school with white kids, but it is about resources. My kids go to a segregated school because it's a majority African American school. And it's a majority white teaching staff. But they make the CBEST test so hard that people of color can't pass the test. And we really need to be looking at what Asian parents are doing, why their children are so successful. Because they have culturally appropriate schools that when they go to these schools that reject them, that treat them badly, which happened to Asian, African American, and Latino kids, they go to Asian school on Saturday and they train their kids. So what we as parents, this pipe dream of integration, it's not happening. We live in a culture that looks at people of color as inferior. It's in the unconscious mind of white people. It's part of the Congress and it's part of our history. So we as parents of color need to be not taking our kids out of that school. We need to be more present, and we need to have Saturday schools and evening schools, and we need to demand that we have more teachers. You know, all of that stuff. We're not changing white people. It's about the economics. I don't want to go to school with them, but I want the same resources that Piedmont Avenue School has in Oakland High. Because I know how to raise my kid. I don't need to sit next to you to raise my kid. But what I do is I need a teacher who has an expectation that my kid will learn. And you don't get that when you have these suburban teachers. You have some of them that are like that, but the majority are like. And life is not changing today.
Dee, you're getting the last word. Sorry, Dee, we're out of time, but you're getting the last word, and we will definitely continue following this very important issue. Thank you for calling. Gary Orfield is professor at UCLA, and Nicole Hannah-Jones is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What are the socioeconomic effects of mega sports events? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with the nation's political sports writer Dave Zirin about his new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. Brazil has faced mass protests over its decision to host the World Cup this summer. So what are these protests about, and what are the human costs of these global sporting events? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.